So this is a hardcore, is it?
So any questions? Please.
Right.
Good question. I think that, So the question for the tape recorder is, what's the difference between metta and well-wishing or prayer? Yeah? To me, this is the way I think of it. The uses of metta that I've come across in the Pali Canon are ones of relationship and balancing. So relationship, metta, is in the context of the four Brahma-viharas, and the four Brahma-viharas are goodwill. So the way I translate metta is goodwill. Karuna, which is compassion. Mudita, which is empathetic joy. And Upekā, which is peacefulness with whatever is. And so the word metta comes in that larger context, that we as human beings can feel empathy for life, and that empathy is available when we let go of our ego functioning and we connect in a heartfelt way to life. And the Buddha said that's very important to do that. Not only does it make you happy, it gives you a better interpretation of life. So empathy. And that's a way of relating to the world. And in terms of balancing, what it is that if my mind is continually moving towards judgmental, averse, self-critical, those types of mindsets, if I introduce an antidote, a balancer, to create a different kind of perception, that's going to help me from getting caught up into that critical, cynical part of me. And then I can use the critical well. If I don't have the critical, cynical, and I only have the empathy, that's also a danger. Because I say, oh yeah, please, come and rob my house. You look like you need a new car, you know, something like that. So we have the critical faculty, and we have that faculty of empathy. We have both. So classically, we use the metta practices to balance out the critical faculty. And you can see that in yourself. You might, like let's say if a child is acting up, you have a critical faculty, okay, child needs a bit of boundary here, but you also have the empathy, yeah, but it's a child. You know, you have both functioning. Prayer and well-wishing is something that exists in all cultures, and we kind of seem to do it. When someone is sick, we say, I'll spread metta to you. And that's very much a sort of hope that somehow my good thoughts and good intentions will help you. Whether that works, I don't know. I know it works for the person doing it. For the sender, the recipient, I don't know how that works. It may or may not work. But that's not the use of metta in Buddhism. But it happens. So we have ideas like making merit for someone that's died. So offering a meal for someone that's very common in Buddhist cultures. You don't really find that much in the texts. Right? But you find it in pre-Buddhist ideas. So what Buddhist cultures have developed is the ideas of prayer. And they are ways, I think, that all culture probably needs to feel good about a difficult situation, that I am doing something, I am praying for their well-being. And so that's the way when I began, I thought, well, wait a minute, we don't do prayer. We're Buddhists. At least I was a hardcore Buddhist. And, you know, we do karma. It's your karma, tough beans. You got to work it out. That kind of, you know, where I'm. So we have like chants. I'm the heir to my karma, born in my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. Right. No prayer. And yet, when my mom was sick and I heard people were chanting for her, I said, oh, thank you. So I saw that, you know, maybe as human beings, we have strategies which maybe they're effective. I don't really know. That we don't have to maybe rationalize that much. That's what I find. I don't rationalize, just do it. Feels good. And the effect, I don't know. But the basic use of the Brahma Viharas is about the human heart's capacity to relate through empathy, types of empathy, and a balancing factor. And then the like prayer, what you'll find as Buddhism evolved, it took on the forms which we call Mahayana Buddhism, and one of the forms it took on was Pure Land. And in Pure Land Buddhism, the idea is that, and this exists in Theravada, that Buddhas arise and pass away through the eons of time. And I take that as a metaphor for wise beings. But some of the Mahayana schools take that very literally, and so there's another Buddha waiting in the wings, waiting until this era of Buddhahood, Gautama, Shakyamuni, passes away, and another Buddha is going to come. So he's sort of parked somewhere else in another realm, waiting to come down. So Pure Land, what it does is it prays to that Buddha, or chants to that Buddha, with a wish that in the next lifetime be reborn with that Buddha in the Pure Land, and then we'll sort everything else out from there. So that's kind of Pure Land Buddhism. This is very devotional. And I, as a Theravada, think, what? You know, where do we get from Four Noble Truths to praying to a deity? So you get these sort of morphs of seed ideas, and that become a whole school, which is rather fascinating. So that doesn't appeal to me. And one of the ways I've tried to look at that in my own, and not to be just conceited about my own way, because that's, you know, my way is the best way. I like the ideas that you have in yoga. And in yoga, you have the ideas of bhakti yoga, devotional yoga, kama yoga, service yoga, jnana yoga, insight yoga, hatha yoga, and so on. So you have these, I think Indian mind recognized that there are different temperaments. And these different temperaments then pick up spiritual practices in particular kinds of avenues. So Pure Land for me would be a kind of bhakti religion, devotional, devotion to the guru. Christianity would be a bhakti division, a bhakti practice. Mother Teresa, whatever her politics and views on contraception and so on, whatever that was about, I don't know, but her, as an archetype, because there's some controversy about her, but as an archetype, she would be kama yoga, karma yoga, service yoga. And you see that in people who work for Doctors Without Borders, or I have a friend who is, she's about 50-ish, tiny Sri Lankan lady, and she's in charge of UNHCR in Afghanistan. And she, you know, she's talking with warlords, and her mother's frightened, you know, for her. She loves it. You love that? Because it's service, right? Bhakti, karma yoga, and jnana yoga, or insight, or wisdom yoga, is the path that we're on. We're insightfully seeing the nature of things, the attachment to things, and realizing the unconditioned. In Christianity, you have like great devotional saints. In Hinduism, you have the great devotional saints like Ramakrishna in the turn of from the 18th to the 19th century. He was a great bhakti practitioner. And he, from his writings, he understood all the other traditions too, but that was his way of devotion. So someone who has a strong devotional sense, and now I'm just speculating because I've never done this, and I think you can only understand one of these traditions if you've done it. You know, I can intellectually have an opinion, and someone in a bhakti condition say, rubbish, you don't know what she's talking about, and I'd say, probably, you're right. So it's just, but that's the way I try to work with it in my own mind. So someone who had true bhakti would use bhakti to give up ego. Someone who had a deep sense of service would would give that deep sense of service to the care of humanity to give up ego. Right? But not all of us can do that. I couldn't do that. This way made sense to me. But not all people want to do this either, in different ways to make different sense to it. So prayer, you know, has all kinds of cultural, anthropological kind of ways that human beings do that. And we do that as human beings. So I suggest just to people who find that helpful, just do it. And then don't even, like, don't worry about whether it's effective or not. You see, but the effect is wholesome. And certainly when we write to people and say, yeah, we heard you were sick, so we did chanting for you, then, you know, they're very happy. They're, you know, they feel loved and cared for. And that's good enough, isn't it? I mean, that's sufficient. Yeah. Anything? Another question? Yeah, Lisa. So the question is, when I've tried to practice right speech diligently, it's often come from a place of fear and not wanting to alienate myself from other people. Yeah. So fear in fear has a wholesome quality, I think, and an unwholesome quality. The wholesome quality in Buddhism, fear is a big word, so each of us has a different take on it. But for me, the words hiri and otapa are the kind of primary words of conscious being, having a sense of conscience in Theravada Buddhism. And hiri otapa is a sense of both regret at doing something which is harmful to others. Sometimes they use the word shame, but shame has difficult interpretations in Western culture. But a sense of regret and remorse at having done something hurtful, and then fear of the consequences of doing something hurtful. And that's a good fear, right? I'm working in an accounting office, and they said, hey, let's embezzle $1 million. Right? You're afraid to do that? Good fear. Very good fear. Very helpful. So fear is, you know, so that's hiri otapa. And in Buddhist iconography, if you go to a Thai temple, you'll see these fearsome beings on either side, the powerful, fearsome beings, and that's hiri otapa. Then you come into this temple, don't mess about conscience. Right? So there's that. But there's also egotistical fear, and there's biological fear, and psychological fear. So psychological fear is more like egotistical fear, isn't it? And there's biological fear. So biological fear, it just comes out when it comes up. So some people have it maybe in an unreasonable way. They're afraid of mice or snakes. You know, and that's kind of unreasonable. So it's a kind of biological fear which has got a psychological weird component to it. Okay, so that's just the way it is. But if you see a bear, you know, we see a bear comes in and sniffs around, I think all of us will feel some kind of adrenaline running, right? It'll be more universal. But psychological fears that we have, wanting to be liked by others, fear of blame, wanting not to disappoint people, and so on and so forth, that's deeply embedded in the way we relate socially. And that we have to work out, otherwise we're never going to be free in any social situation. So becoming conscious of that, fear, is the way of using, I think, the body. So if in your discourse with people, you can see the arising of that as a bodily component, then you have the best chance of not reacting through it. And that's the skill we're trying to develop. We're trying to develop a kind of a second level of consciousness among us. There's a primary level of consciousness of trying to talk with this person intelligently. And there's that background level of consciousness, which is, what's the reaction going on now? And is it skillful or unskillful? And you get better and better at that. So when when we're younger, like when you see an adolescent trying to develop an ego, and they're very fearful. It's embarrassing, isn't it? You know, some young guy trying to look tough. Trouble is, when they're 40, they might be really tough, and it's coming from fear, and then it's frightening. Right? We don't even see the fear anymore. So the fact that one is conscious of social fears, I think, is a healthy thing. And if you're not aware of it, then you're just acting out some ego personality, which might not be harmful, but it's still very limiting, very much a social suffering. So being conscious of fear, I think, is very good, very, very good. And then being more and more aware of it as an object, you will less and less speak through it, because you'll see it as an object. You'll see how your speech is now warped by this fear, and you'll do it less, just in the nature of things. You'll do it less because the consequences are not good. So you see the consequences of speaking through fear, and then there's more fear and more doubt or whatever. It doesn't work. And just intuitively, you become aware of that, and you try to speak from a place of clarity. And we can do that. We can be aware of it. And it's not like analyzing all the time. It's just saying, oh. So the more you can be aware of fear as a kind of vitality rather than a particular personal interchange. It's not about me or them. It's just about this type of vitality which has arisen. The more you'll know it, and you won't react through it. But these are deeply rooted. These are deeply rooted things. I think the positive thing that because it's conscious, you can be free from it. Like I don't know to say, consciousness is the escape hatch. And now it's up in the surface. It's okay. Right? Now you know it. You're not. It's not submerged, and you're just playing a game, being driven by that. You get better and better at it. So be encouraged. Yeah, be encouraged. Except. So the question is, can I elaborate on one of the four factors of right mindfulness, the specific one of preventing the unwholesome from arising, the unwholesome which has not yet arisen? It comes from intention. It comes from intention. Body, speech, and mind. So let's say I'm new to the meditation game and I'm just starting. And I notice I have road rage. And so I'm driving in heavy downtown Ottawa traffic. And someone cuts me off and takes my parking place. And now I've just begun the contemplative life, right? I've just started on that path, being aware. And I see myself giving a finger to the guy that's taken my parking spot. I wanted to yell at him. And I notice that, right? And I say to myself, I'm going to try not to go with the body language or the speech in that one. So that intention sets me up for the next time. Someone cuts me off again. That habit's going to be there because I've been driving for 20 years and I've indulged in road rage. So I can't just say, with one intention, I'm going to be free from this habit. Mind isn't conditioned that way, it's conditioned in the way it's conditioned. So my intention also has to be grounded in sobriety, in a kind of sober relationship to my habits, that this will take time. This isn't an instantaneous result just because I'd like it not to happen. And that's a kind of kindness to oneself, a kind of generosity to oneself, and just a reasonableness around how you can train the mind. You know, just kind of a wisdom understanding. So I make the intention to notice the desire to yell at the person or do some kind of horrible body language. And I make that intention. The next time that happens, there's more chance that I'll be more aware. Because I've now made the intention to be aware of the arising. Okay? And I may get lost, but now I'll notice it more strongly because I've made the intention, even just a little bit. And each time I get lost in it and I make the intention, that intentionality builds mindfulness around the particular place that did not have mindfulness, around the particular area where I was heedless and got caught. Right? And it builds. And at some point, I don't yell and I don't do some kind of hand gesture, and I just don't go there. But I make the intention, I'm going to try to notice the arising of the mental state, and I get better and better at it. And at some point with road rage, if I work at it, I suddenly realize, hey, I didn't react. Look at that. And we all have that, don't we? You know, like I have that. We all have that where you think about 20 years ago, would have really reacted to this thing, moved through me, and think, hey, that was me. I didn't react. Now, why is that? It wasn't because I just said, I'm not going to react. No, because I trained. So the wholesome thing, in terms of right effort, the wholesome was awakening to the unskillfulness and making the intentions not to follow the unskillfulness. Now, that's a sort of simplistic example, but it does fit most things. So let's say I'm bored and I've got an iPad, right? And I feel bored and I think, what's happening in the world? And 3 hours later, I look around and notice there's a world around me, right? And so I said, wow, look at that, 3 hours on this iPad. I'm addicted to media. Right? And then I say, well, wait a minute. Probably wasn't the Buddhist path. Probably a bit of wrong effort there. And I realize, well, I'm going to try to work with this need to always be absorbed into a screen or absorbed into an object. And why do I do that? I begin to see that the Buddhist idea is liberation. The unconditioned, the uncreated, that realization is not an object. And so the effort I make now, I realize, no, if I'm going to take this path to its deepest level, I have to give up my addiction to objects. So this is another way we make right effort, is we have a profound realization what the path is about. And our giving up is no longer just moral or social, or even grossly emotional, it's now more profound because we've seen that the path to liberation is hindered by our constant preoccupation with objects. Right? So, got my iPad, and it's all interesting. I did 4 YouTubes on Buddhism, 6 YouTubes on woodwork, right? And now I'm a wiser being. Not really, I'm just addicted to YouTube. And I can tell you about woodworking and Buddhism. Basically, every time I stop, I need to look at a YouTube. So, now, because I'm a contemplative, so, oh, what's the problem here? And it is a problem if you're taking this to a really deep spiritual level. The problem is the addiction to objects. And now I make an intention now. I'm going to try to notice my need for objects. Huh? So I make a resolution. And this is one of the ways we develop right effort is adhitana, or determination. I make a resolution that I'm only going to look at my iPad 5 times a day for a maximum of 38 minutes. So 5 times, reasonable, right? 5 times a day. But I'm used to kind of getting lost in it for 3 hours or 4 hours. So I wake up and look at my emails and da, 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 ding, the 38 minute bell goes, okay, stop. I stop. And then I do that, and you know, it's only 3 in the afternoon and I've done my 5 at 38 minutes. Now it's 5 in the afternoon, I've still got a whole long evening ahead of me, right? And then I notice this desire to look at something, this restlessness to look at an object. And I think my determination was stupid, and I look, and I keep looking at it. And this is what happens with determinations. You have a great idea, and this is the way I'm going to make effort. And then when it really gets difficult to make the effort, you don't make the effort. And you say, that was a no. But then you think, well, wait a minute. I want to develop myself. And the development of determination, or adhitana paramita, is a very important one in the spiritual practice. We make determinations which help us to abandon the unskillful. So I make this determination about the iPad, and I look at it. Now I really notice, after maybe 3 hits of the iPad, I've got 2 left, it's still in the afternoon, I notice my desire more. And I notice that, oh, I've only got two left. Maybe I'll just wait. So now that first impulse, which I followed before, now say, no, no, I'll wait. And I've noticed desire for objects, and I've not ran with it. I've had more strength now. Right? Comes up again. No, I'll put it down. Now I'm seeing the desire for objects as an object of mind. Now I begin to have some insight. Right? And so I use that very addiction to something which isn't immoral or bad or wrong, I use it to understand this inclination we have to always be preoccupied with objects. And as I do that, I realize, okay, what happens if I'm not preoccupied with objects? I begin to notice the space of the mind, and as I open to the space of the mind, I realize the unconditioned, which is the spiritual part, which is the liberating part. But as long as I'm preoccupied with conditions, there's no space. There's no space for that. And that's a deeper sense of adhitana or determination, deeper than just my road rage. Right? So it's based upon insight, wisdom, and intentions around that wisdom. And those, some of the insights are just kind of really obvious. You know, road rage is stupid. I'm not thinking, why am I doing this stupid thing? But the other not seeking objects is a much more subtle, and that's what the spiritual life is about, I think. You know, it's not just a being a good person life, it's deeper than that. So there's many levels of that, but the patterns are the same. It's about wisdom, understanding, and then intention. Those keep making it deeper and deeper. And that's not hating yourself for them. You know, hating yourself for some habit doesn't work, because it creates another habit. So I was talking to our accountant the other day, and you know, he said it's about process, and we're talking about getting, you know, some things straightened away in our accounting process, which is fine. But I thought, yeah, that's what the Buddha's teaching is about. It's about process rather than personality. When I'm a personality, and I'm doing something which is not appropriate, then I hate myself and get on myself. Whereas processes, yeah, with this as condition that arises. With this being that comes to be. When this doesn't, if this doesn't happen, that doesn't come to be. So I see, oh, when I don't go out to objects, I notice the space of the mind. Process, rather than, oh, you shouldn't be doing this or you shouldn't be doing that. You should be different. Personality. Huh? And process is the way of looking at the khandhas as a process. And that which knows the process has changed is beyond the process. And that's very subtle. It's very subtle. Alright? Mm-hmm. Homework? Curtis? With action.
And but there's right action. So you talk about right intention as a goal. And if I hear you right effort is like the facilitating right energies that lead us to either not to avoid unskillful actions or to, you know, pursue skillful actions also. So it sounds like it's still kind of a mental part.
I wonder if you can chop it up. You know, maybe you can't really chop it up like that. Like, you know, we have exercise machine. I'm 68. What do I like to do? Not exercise. I'm on the machine, you know, it's been 20 minutes. Very interesting. And heart rate goes down, it's slower and slower. Come on, let's go. And I put more effort in. So it's physical, it's mental, it's intention. So I don't think you can really chop it up, but you know what, like, how much effort does it take me to lift this? And how much effort does it take me to keep going for the 45 minutes or half an hour of vigorous exercise? That's different. I think where you get the subtlety of effort is like, what's letting go mean? I mean, what does non-attachment mean? What does non-grasping mean? And that's very mental. That's very mental. So I see myself feeling frustrated. What does letting go of frustration mean? Does it mean that I shouldn't, you know, I try to get rid of it or get an argument? What does letting go mean? Frustration feels this way. What is non-grasping? That is a hard lesson to learn, right? And each of us just gets more and more intuitive about what non-grasping or letting go is. Like Patrick, I remember Patrick used to like, he used like to say, he doesn't like letting go, so he likes the word letting be. And that worked for him better. But whatever word you use, there's something about the khandhas arising and ceasing and the non-grasping of the khandhas, which is the fundamental. And that's around the perception of change. And to shift your attention from frustration to the awareness of frustration as a changing object is right effort. Just to make that shift. And that comes from wisdom, there's an intention behind it, and there's a doing. So whether you can really chop them up into mind moments, and there's a, you know, but they're all part of it. You see that meditation a lot, don't you? You know, when we first started, and we'd sit through pain through just blind willfulness, and which just made the mind not want to meditate. And like exercise, I find that, you know, if I just willfully push myself for half an hour, I don't do it for the next 6 days. But if I notice the desire not to exercise, and I say, oh, this is the feeling of not wanting exercise, but I keep exercising, then I'm happy to do it the next day. Because it hasn't been a painful imposition of my will on my body. It's been the same amount of time, but the attitude has been one of mindfulness of aversion as opposed to willful suppression of aversion. And that's the awakening, the wisdom, the letting go, the knowing. So it's, you know, I think, you know, all this language you use are pointing to one thing, it's non-grasping. Non-grasping. So, like, when I do the exercise, I have to non-grasp my laziness. Because that's what prevents it. That's what prevents it. So why do I do that? Well, my dad had a stroke at 74, so I'm 68. Probably, you know, I better... It's been 6 years, I better get my act together. Language is very rational and chalked up. Lajan Chah would say, yeah, you know, you can analyze these things, but it's like you can analyze the branches of a tree, but when you fall out of the tree, all the branches just whack them down. Life is much more quick. So there's a lot of kind of intuitive sensibilities here. And it gives the rational mind stuff to work with. Mentally.
But it seems to me that, you know, the number of days,
in the Pali, it covers it very nicely. In the Pali, you have the word dukkha, which is suffering, and it's used in three ways. I've been through this the other day sometimes, so if I'm doing this again, my apologies. But first of all, you have three: dukkha vedana, dukkha satcha, and dukkha lakana. Dukkha vedana is the unpleasant sensations that we have because we are incarnate in a body which needs to feel pain. If I didn't feel the pain of a nail, like if I step on a nail and goes through my foot, if I didn't know that, that'd be very dangerous. So the body has pleasure and pain as a natural biological function. Necessary. Neither right nor wrong, it is as it is. So that's called dukkha and sukha vedana. Vedana being the kind of affect. Dukkha satcha is the suffering in the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Truths of suffering, and that's mental suffering. The suffering I have when I attach to that with that storyline. But more deeply, dukkha lakana is the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness. And that characteristic is a reflection, or is mirrored by, the Buddha's realization of what is truly satisfactory. And his realization of enlightenment is truly satisfactory because he realized the unconditioned, or nibbana, or so on, or whatever ways spiritual language we want to use. And he said, okay, there is that possibility. But if you're always paying attention to objects, characteristics of objects, you will miss this because you're looking in the wrong place, you're distracted. So he says, all objective experience, all sense experience, has the characteristic of being unsatisfactory. It's all dukkha, we say. So this is where people get confused about Buddhism. They say, it's all dukkha means that there's no beauty, but there is beauty. But beauty has the characteristic of being unsatisfactory in relationship to the unconditioned. If I realize that beauty, calmness, peace, bright light, is unsatisfactory, or it's not permanent, or it will change, then I tend to have gratitude. Oh, great, it's a good day. And as Ajahn Sumedho so often says to me, when it's really nice, this is Virdhamo, this is a peak experience. And it's a nice way, he's very compassionate, rather than saying, this is going to change. He doesn't put a downer on it. He lifts you, hey, this is a peak experience, go for it. But he's saying it's peak, and he's saying, you know, it's not going to last. It's going to change. That's a good way to put it. So this is where you get confused in Buddhism, where he's saying that sukha vedana has dukkha lakana. Right? And that's important to see that the deeper kind of dukkha the Buddha is pointing to is our fascination with objects. And that's maybe what you're alluding to, that dukkha vedana is still dukkha, you know, if you caught up with it. Now, if you are then inclining towards the unconditioned, and you patiently witness the attachment to pleasure and pain, and you go beyond that, you go beyond the Four Noble Truths, as it were, to the realization of the unconditioned, to the deepest realization that humans can have. So that word dukkha is very, or suffering, if it's looked at in those three aspects, it's much more meaningful. When it gets translated into English, it's kind of whitewashed, and the nuances of that get kind of confused, right? Is that a good bit? Yeah. Yeah, it's a peak experience. I use that a lot. That brings up gratitude. You know, it's all kind of going nice, and monks are all in harmony, and like in a monastery, sometimes, you know, everything's going nice and it's harmonious and efficient. And then we have crazy times. One monk has misunderstood another monk, and then they come to me and, did this and did that, and did that, did that. And I say, oh yeah, it's supposed to be this way. Yeah, it's supposed to be disharmonious. I don't say this is a bummer. But you know that relationship to the peak experience, and it's supposed to change. Then you get your mind moves towards gratitude and patience. When it attaches to the beauty, then it moves to greed and anger, right? On the same kind of life cycles that we have. So does this format work okay for OBS? We'll try to get the meditation home. Okay, my pleasure. This works well for us. Just, you know, because obviously you like to invite people into your home in this way. So this is, I'm glad you took this initiative, you know. And now that we have this tent, it's doable. Yeah, it's doable. So the next meeting will be in a month's time. I forget the date. So just to remind you, anyone who's local, we have the meditation every Saturday at 1 o'clock. No, it's fine.